John Harvey, do you want to state the issue again? I do want to think about it, but
Well, we've just been discussing this issue a little bit. In thermodynamics, there's a distinction between heat and work.
Yes.
Now, really, the basis of this reasoning is not strictly classical thermodynamics, it's statistical mechanics. You do have a fundamental theory. You have thermodynamic-like variables. But they're really, all of that stuff is really reducible to the fundamental theory. So it is a little bit more like statistical mechanics.
That's the proposal.
Yeah, and that's what motivates the connection between entropy and information.
Yes.
It's the statistical mechanical understanding of thermodynamic variables or principles. Now, what is not entirely clear, I think, to both of us is why Team Yunyu, well, of course, Team Yunyu is stress energy. Could be something like it. But to make it heat, maybe there have to be restrictions on Team Yunyu in some sense. But I'm a little bit confused about this.
I mean, in the simple picture, you know, if you talk about T delta S, and you try to understand that in terms of information or something like that, you know that, okay, there's this change and stuff, and that's a change because of the change of information, you know, you get, or you know, or what you don't know, or what you do know, or something like that. It's, now maybe, what you learn is if this baseball, or if this well-defined electromagnetic field that you would never describe using statistical mechanics or thermodynamics, but if that's your team you knew, well, maybe that's the information or something, I don't know, that's coming, but it's, you know, it's not quite clear how I'm to think of a well-defined laser pulse, right, or a well-defined baseball that comes into my domain and actually obviously brings energy, and no doubt about that.
Yes.
Why do I associate that with heat?
Well, I think if I take a stab at it, it's energy. So we're in that domain that we call domain one. We can get, we wouldn't be having this conversation if we couldn't receive things from the past of our past horizon. But we can't influence anything there. So here's a domain that we are unable to influence. So we are considering that, therefore, isolated from ourselves, unable to act on it. But it sends us a package of something which we were unable to control, we were unable to influence. And the assumption is that that's heat because we don't know anything else about it.
If somebody just sends laser pulses to me,
that, according to this definition, was, according to this derivation,
yeah,
it's consistent with the Einstein equations to count that as heat.
But at least, for not, you know, I mean, let's say there's no accelerating observers, but I'm just sitting here and I have a colleague, you know, far away, and there are some laser pulses that start coming at me that he sent me. Would I call that heat?
No, but maybe the reason why there's a DS is that we're unable to control any initial conditions here. Because it's to our past of our past horizon. And so when we get that, we gain some information.
Well, anytime somebody sends me a laser pulse, of course, I get some information.
Right.
I mean, even if we're in flat space-time, nobody's accelerating, we're just
right,
two different regions, you know, somebody sends me a laser pulse, I get some information.
So the assumption is, let's follow this, that I get some information, and the information I get is the amount of energy I got divided by the temperature, or is limited by that.
Right, of course, in obvious, in simple cases, if there's no accelerating observers, the temperature can be zero.
Right, but there happens to be a temperature here.
Right.
And there happens to be a context in which I'm in equilibrium before and after I receive this information, the same temperature. So So maybe given that I wasn't able to control what was coming at me.
Well, but let's say what's coming at me is in fact just a deterministic pulse of.
Yes, I mean, let's say it's okay. An encyclopedia.
Let's say it's a deterministic pulse of what. Yeah. What is it going to do? Is it going to heat up my little detector, my little Unruh detector?
Well, we determine not in the long run. It might temporarily.
Yeah.
But that's not relevant because there's an infinite heat sink to the other side of it.
Right. But if I know how I normally think about if I have a detector that's in thermal equilibrium, and I now have some heat coming at it in the sense of black body radiation. I know what's going to happen to that, you know, sort of reduced density operator as a function of time, right? I can build some little model for it. It's going to go, it's going to go up, it's going to come back down. But it's not going to acquire any, there's never going to be an expectation value of the dipole moment of that oscillator that's induced, right? The actual expectation value of the energy is going to go up, and it'll go down as it comes back into equilibrium. That's rather different than if I send a deterministic laser pulse at it. The transient cases, there's really going to be an expectation value of the dipole moment that's going to be induced. Ta-da. And then it's going to go back to the old temperature. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the effect of that deterministic T alpha beta on my little Unruh detector seems qualitatively different than how I would think. I would normally understand heat of some sort being incident on the Unruh detector.
So, well, in three dimensions, of course, the laser pulse can go past the detector and miss you completely. So the point is that something is coming into Rindler 1.
Yeah,
not
but
that something is detected.
I'm puzzled. I think we want to, let me try just once more. I think I want to say something like, because of whatever comes in, whether it's thermal or pulse, I'll gain some information. Let's start there. So delta I. There's then, I also happen to be at some constant temperature. There's then a claim that there's a relationship between delta I, the amount of energy that passed through, and the temperature. Now, you want to make the point that that's only the case for heat, and heat is radiation which is in equilibrium.
Something like that.
And if it's not, then why should there be a relationship between T,
yeah,
information?
Yeah, that's
yeah. And let me try from an, okay. People who build computers believe that just to store or to erase a bit of information at a temperature T requires an expenditure of energy of log 2 of T times log 2. So supposing I store some information, that I needed some energy to help me. So that's the, I'm making this up as fast as I'm
but not necessarily heat. I mean,
yeah. So I don't know. I see your point, and I think this bears.
I mean, the thing obviously has a lot of strength. I mean, the way it, I'm not denying that, right? It's very impressive. It's just that I'd be a bit more comfortable with the argument if I had a better sense of how that energy flow can be thought of as like heat.
Good.
And I can't. That's what I can't do at the moment. That's where I'm stuck.
So I think I propose we all think about this, and I'll also communicate with Ted. And maybe he has, having thought about this, has a good plan. Okay. So what I wanted to, besides the intrinsic interest and the connection with the ideas we were discussing before, I wanted to present this because of the last comment that I made. So the last comment that I made is that is you can take this and a number of other arguments, some of which I can sketch to you, as plausibility arguments that space-time is not fundamental. And I want to distinguish several. So are we happy to start a new line of discussion? So let me leave those there and start here. I want to focus on the implications of that, and there are implications for, you know, quote, philosophical issues like the nature of time, the nature of law. There are also issues for strategies for progress in physics. But let me just write down some assertions that are made or that might be made. So one of them is that space is emergent. And I'm going to use this word over and over again. So what I mean by emergent is not part of the language of a more fundamental theory. That is, I don't think we need to worry about ultimate theories or the last theory, or, you know, the final blah, blah, blah theory. We're trying to solve various problems that are presented to us about the relationship of quantum mechanics to general relativity, about the meaning of the Big Bang and the possible role of initial condition in cosmology, about communication. And in the context of answering that set of questions, there we are searching for a more fundamental description. And so we might call this, I'm just going to label these, searching A. Assertion B is space and time are emergent. And the distinction between them is what it looks like, that is, in distinction A, there still would be some notion of time in the fundamental language of description. Although, of course, what the proper notion of time is left open. Proposal C is that the metric is emergent, and proposal D is, quote, the continuum or the manifold. I'm going to use the continuum. Manifold you hear all those things, and I wanted to start by distinguishing them and maybe talking a little bit about where the arguments for each of those come from. So comments before, I want to just give some examples of each of those. This is so pretty, it's hard to rub it out, but this diagram is in the paper. Thank you. let me start with C, because we've seen a couple of, C is sort of the easiest case, and there are a couple of examples of it that we've seen already. So one version is the Flavatsky approach to general relativity. So if you remember, the action there was a function of this field B, this field F, and then it had some other field, phi AB, BA wedge BB. And there was a theory in which there was a continuous manifold. Therefore, there was some sense space and time. But the metric was a consequence of the field equations. So if we believe in that version of the world for a moment, so there's no quantum mechanics yet, but it's a classical world where there is a four-dimensional space-time manifold, there is diffeomorphism invariance, there is a gauge field, there are some other fields around, but it happens that only when we solve the field equation do we discover that there is a space-time metric and a notion of distance and so forth. And a question that might be asked is, should we take that seriously? That is that pointing to the, is the existence of a formulation of general relativity where the metric is a consequence of some solutions, and of course it's not a consequence of all solutions. There are solutions of the theory, for example, where B is equal to zero, where there is just, is no metric. But nonetheless, they're good solutions of the theory. So the existence of there being a space-time metric is contingent. Should we take that as evidence for anything? And I want to mention two things that I think are interesting and might be said in defense of C. So one of them is that the action is cubic. I don't know, I forget if I mentioned this when I was talking about the Lebesgue action, but it's cubic in the basic variables. The usual action of general relativity is not even a polynomial function of the basic variables being the metric and the fields. This is not only polynomial, it's cubic. And why is it impressive that it's cubic? It means that the field equations are quadratic. And what that means, and I've only been thinking about this recently, so maybe you're going to tell me I'm off the wall for taking this seriously. But they couldn't be simpler. If they were simpler, they would be linear equations. But then there would be no interactions. Linear field equations are field equations of theories without interactions. You know, things like Fox 5 equals 0 are linear equations. So physics is nonlinear because there are interactions. The simplest interesting theory that you could imagine would be therefore one based on quadratic equations. And this happens to be. And it happens to be that the Einstein equations, which are non-polynomial, have a set of solutions which are encompassed in the solutions of a much simpler theory, which has, you know, a different set of degrees of freedom and quadratic equations. And you might take the view that that was significant because it was as simple as possible. As if one is looking for unification, then the simpler the equations of motion, the more fundamental the insight you have into the dynamics, and nothing could be simpler. So I don't know if that's a nonsense rhetorical propaganda argument or if that's a significant argument. But that, I'd be curious for comments about that. I've been thinking about that, and I'll indicate a little bit later why I've been thinking about that. Yes?
So, isn't it just that, in this case, the role of communities were replaced by the scalar fields? So that, okay, maybe the metric emerges, but in this theory, the metric was, there's something else that's fundamental instead of the metric, which is the phi.
Sure, but who would you have guessed that you could replace Einstein's field equations with F, which after all has a linear part and a quadratic part is equal to some phi times a b. A linear equation, a linear term plus a quadratic term is some other quadratic term. And some certain combinations of b and b are zero. Those are really quadratic equations of motion. I don't know if that's I mean, if you ask the question, could there be anything simpler? And this is an argument that there could be. I mean, there could be other quadratic equations, but given that we know the general relativity is nonlinear, it's not going to be replaced by some linear set of equations, as it's genuinely nonlinear. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a mathematician. I don't know how to make the argument as a mathematical argument. Anyway, that impresses me, and that goes somewhere, which I'll mention when we get to the other thing. A consequence of that is certainly that the quantization program. Progress. So I think that's the minimal claim that you can make for the activity that follows from loop quantum gravity and spin foam models. A lot of non-trivial results have been found along a research program towards the quantum theory. As I emphasized, it's not done, at least in my view. Some people disagree, but in my view, it's not done. And it's not done because of issues that come at the very end, having to do with the meaning of probability in the absence, in the cosmological case, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, etc. But one goes a great deal further, and is confirmed by rigorous mathematical results than whatever got with the metric. So because the Einstein equations expressed in terms of the metric are not only very complicated, but non-polynomial, translating them into either a precise operator language, making sense of the infinite number of operator products involved, or into a precise path integral measure was never done. But there are precise operator and Hilbert space instantiations of all but the last step of the quantization and all the steps of the construction of the path interval. So that's suggestive. Um, third piece of evidence, I'm just, what I want to do in this discussion, and I hope at some point you start telling me where I'm being stupid and this turns into a discussion, is really more than I have so far, is expose my sort of recent thinking about these things. And so I'm going to mention things in recent work that I'm happy to explain but haven't come up yet. This Blavatsky approach, so a criticism that nonetheless, you know, a very valid criticism that has been made about group quantum gravity and spin flow models, in spite of what I just said, is, oh, well, that's an academic exercise, that's nice, but what about the problem of unification? What about the, you know, the relationship between gravity and the other three interactions in the standard model? What about fermions? What about chirality, not just fermion, but chiral fermions, which have this amazing property that in the face of enormous quantum corrections, they can remain massless or very light. What about the standard model of particle physics? The strong case made for string theory as a background-dependent perturbative approach to quantum gravity is that it automatically encompasses the unification of gravity. And I'll come back to that issue. Okay. So it's interesting, and it's something that was kind of known and kind of not really taken seriously until the last 6 months or so, is that the Blavatsky approach admits a very natural expansion to a unification of general relativity with gauge theories. So this admits unification with Yang-Mills theory. Basically, by taking the group, which in the way I presented before was SU2, and just extending it to some bigger group, where H has a subgroup, which is SU2, plus some standard model group. So it's a little bit more than that, and again, if people want, I can mention that. That's the second to last paper I put on the archive. But there are references that go back to Peter Pelton in 1993, which, from a Hamiltonian point of view, discovered those extensions. Although the relationship to the Blavatsky form of the action was not understood then. And so there was a little bywater until Garrett Lisi came and stirred the waters of unification up quite a bit. And one of the things that dropped out of Lisi's work was an understanding of that, of how this was back. So this is something I can say more about if there's interest. So even at the classical level, is a plausible investigation of the metric being emergent, even at the level of classical field theory. And if you take it seriously, it suggests that what's more fundamental is the notion of parallel transport. So basically, the idea is that the metric is emergent, but parallel transport is fundamental, more fundamental. So now I think there's a lot there to think about that hasn't been thought about. For example, the role of causality in causal structure, which is so fundamental in our usual understanding of the Einstein equations. Does it just drop from nothing? Is there some prior notion of causal structure in the Lebesgue theory? What's going on there? Because I think we haven't yet gotten to quantum mechanics, but even before quantum mechanics and quantum gravity, there are some very interesting notions. Yes.
I may have misunderstood here, but if you're able to provide unification, would that account for the way in which the non-gravitational interactions coupled to GMU to GR?
Yeah.
If that's the case, then you can explain the local validity of special relativity.
Yes.
Which means that you can explain why the null cones have at least approximately a causal structure.
Yes. But interestingly, it's not put in, it comes out
yeah.
from solutions. And there are solutions right. that have that character, and there are other solutions that don't have that character.
But the ones that don't have that character presumably have a different causal structure.
Well, it's not clear that they have any causal structure at all. No. So, for example, some solutions that don't have that character have B equals zero, and therefore the metric equals zero, right. but still there's a gauge field, but those are topological. So they have no local degrees of freedom, so there's no notion of a causal structure. But is that always the case? That is it always the case that the solutions are either give you a metric or give you something that doesn't require a causal structure because there's no local degrees of freedom? There are questions like that, I don't know.
But you're able to derive the strong equivalence principle in this unification.
I guess so. Did you want me to show you to show that? Let me.
Well, I would like to.
Okay. Let me see if by according to.
Because that's a big mystery in GR.
Let me keep going with what I plan to do and see if we have some time left over or, it's probably going to be the next hour and a half if we don't have a 5 hour. I think of it as 15 minutes, but that's because I know it. And also because it's been at least a month since we discussed the Lebesgue formalism here, so I have to remind you of There's another, in the work on quantum gravity, there's another set of results which can be taken at the quantum mechanical level as evidence for C, which is that the states in new quantum gravity and related programs are graphs embedded of topology in a manifold. So the manifold is still there. The fundamental degrees of freedom, or the fundamental, the normalizable basis that's simplest to compute with, are these graphs embedded up to topology. If I just gave you that theory, you wouldn't have a notion of distance, you wouldn't have a notion of causal structure. Nonetheless, in that theory, we can construct operators, which we know from the correspondence to the classical theory, measure integrated functions of the metric, like the volume of a region or the area of a surface. So we can construct composite operators that measure metric quantities, but there's no fundamental. There's no operator in the theory, which is G, A, B, at the point X. And of course we tried, there's no such operator. And it's an interesting fact, there are operators that represent areas of surfaces, of volumes, of regions. Those surfaces and regions can be just described kinematically. They can be described dynamically by coupling to matter degrees of freedom using, say, the values of a scale field to define a surface and computing the operator that measures the volume of the interior of the surface where the scale field vanishes and things like that. And all those things have been done. But there's no notion, but those are, you know, complicated operator functionals of the fundamental operators of the theory. There's no operator that corresponds to measuring the metric at a point. And in the half integral, that is the spin foam approaches to the path integral based on loop quantum gravity, the role of causal structure is discussed but is not really understood. There were some proposals about it at the beginning by Fontini. It's been developed by a few people, but it's not really understood. And what's typical but disappointing is that most of the precise results that we understand, not all of them, but many of them, correspond to the Euclidean extension of the theory. And there is this thing which there's almost a sort of a moral play. I mean, the existence of the Euclidean quantum gravity, which is to say quantum gravity, which is the quantum theory of a metric with signature plus, 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 is disturbing. And I think that from a philosophical point of view, it should be very disturbing. Because any result, supposing I give you a quantum theory of gravity, and I give you parallel to that a quantum theory of a space-time manifold with the Euclidean signature metric on it, and one for one I equate the result. So every result for the alleged real world is matched to a result with the Euclidean metric. But we know classically a space-time is very different than a four-dimensional manifold with the Euclidean metric. The space-time has many properties such as light cones, causal structure, caustics, etc., which are not, have no analog for a Euclidean metric. Nonetheless, the classical theory exists, that is, you can solve the Einstein equations with Riemannian signature, and there are approaches to quantum gravity where most of the results are concerned the corresponding problem with Euclidean signature. There are even approaches to quantum gravity where all the results have to do or are about the quantum space-time with Euclidean signature. And I think this is disturbing. And again, I think it bears discussion by philosophers or level. Let me leave it. I mean, I can make a long rant about that. Let me leave it at that. So the main point here is that the metric is emergent not only in these approaches to classical generality, but maybe not surprising in the approach to quantum gravity related to them. It's emergent quantum mechanically in quantum gravity and spin foam models. That is, the fundamental language of description in loop quantum gravity is not about the metric. You only encounter quantities having to do with the metric because you care about them, because that come from the classical. Okay. I think now I want to make my point, which I said before, but I want to rub it in. It's very plausible that the metric is emergent in these approaches to classical and quantum gravity. But if the metric is emergent, then causal structure is emergent. And then what happens to the notion of causality, which is a fundamental part of the notion of time, well, you know, not just in general relativity. So, and I just want to leave that. Implies, you know, what is the fate of causality? And I don't know the answer. I know some proposed answers, but I don't know the answer. Yeah.
Can you say them?
Can I what?
Can you say the proposed answers?
Yeah, so one proposed answer is that that what is fundamental is some dynamical system. And I'll give you some examples of that with a large number of degrees of freedom. And I'll give you some examples. And there is time. And there's no notion of space. Let me approach this through A. So could space be emergent and time not be emergent? Let me give you an example of a research program that attempts to address that very explicitly. So this research program is called Quantum Gravity. I don't have the reference. The most recent reference is about 2 months ago with Spottini, Marco Pulo, Thomas Canoca, and Simone Severini. And here's the dynamical system. The dynamical system is consider a complete graph on n nodes. So when n is large, and I'm going to give you, this is just the first of several examples. So, so that is the complete graph on four nodes. For every pair of nodes, there's an edge, ij, the ijth node, which is same thing as the JI node, let's say. And I'll give you the classical description and the quantum mechanical description. I'll just give you the quantum mechanical description. Is that this is a two-state system, so there's a little two-state system with the basis elements 0 and 1 associated with every edge. So the Hilbert space product of all I less than j of the two-dimensional Hilbert space each pair, and we interpret the ground state as the absence of an edge, and the excited state as the presence of an edge. And so every basis, so to every graph, say, here's a possible graph, is associated a state, a basis state in the Hilbert space. And there is some Hamiltonian, which I'm not going to write. But it's a simple local Hamiltonian. And what these authors argue is that the ground state for n very large is a 2D hexagonal lattice that is that you get a pattern of who is on that looks like tiling in your bathroom, at least if you grew up in a pre-war building in New York City. Okay. So they call that the emergence of space. It's a system which has nothing to do with space. It has local degrees of freedom. It has degrees of freedom that have nothing to do with space. It has time, so there is time. There's a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has the property that the ground state breaks. So there's a lot of symmetry in the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has the symmetry of the permutation group on that element. So there's no preferred edge or node in the Hamiltonian, but nonetheless, in the ground state, a lot of symmetry is broken. Most of the nodes are turned off. They're on the order of n squared degrees of freedom, but only on the order of 3n are turned on in the ground state, and so there emerges a spatial structure. Yeah.
Have they considered what a domain wall would mean in that structure?
I don't know. You should ask them. I mean, there are various things that can be and are being investigated. Okay.
To clarify, am I right in understanding that the idea is space emerges as some sort of crystallization of this graph?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's crude, but it's effective.
Where do we get the Hamiltonian?
They make it up.
To get this answer.
Yeah. But I mean, that's not. The question is there a simple Hamiltonian that you can compute with it such that that's true? And the answer seems to be yes. Okay. Let me give you, while we're on the subject of space emerging, let me give you another example. Did you want to ask something about
it? Very quickly, why two-dimensional, if it's supposed to be space?
That's the simplest form of the Hamiltonian.
Okay, ideally they'd be looking for a three-dimensional lattice.
Yeah. And they can mock up the Hamiltonian and give them three dimensions as well.
But when you say space emerges, I mean, do you mean space with a metric?
No. I mean, there is a distance function on the structure of the graph that emerges as the ground state. But this is a long way to go from physics propagating through space-time. It's just an example of a kind of thing that people study. They then add some more degrees of freedom, so this is not just a two-state system, but a four-state system. And in the context of a four-state system, there are degrees of freedom that propagate on the space. And indeed, they get Maxwell electrodynamics on a two-dimensional space as an approximation to the dynamics. So that's actually a much more impressive result. You get not just, when the thing is a four-state system, you get not just space or no space, but you get space plus photons propagating out of space.
But that means there must be a three-dimensional metric.
Two plus one dimensional. Yes. Okay, there is a speed of light, and it's a function of the parameters of theory.
Is there a simple way to get a non-abelian field?
Yes, more degrees of freedom.
Just more degrees of freedom. What about labeling and labels on the ground or something?
Could investigate that too. That's the same thing with more degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
But that means that without those extra degrees of freedom, without the dynamics, the notion of distance doesn't mean anything. Distance, as it were, is some amount of, it's some aspect of the dynamics, as it were.
Well, it's some aspect of the solutions.
Right.
That is, and notice, I mean, there is actually many, many solutions. There's many, many ground states which all look like this, but in this particular one, this edge and this edge, this node and this node are neighbors, but there are ground states in which any two nodes are late, are neighbors, in which that edge was left turned on and every others were left were turned off in such a way that this one looks next to this one in the lattice. So who is local and who is not local, who is neighbors and who is not, is a function of the solution. And then they show that excitations of this low line, there's a spectrum of low-lying excitations, we propagate like photons. They make use there of very pretty results of Wen and collaborators. But Wen did not have a dynamical lattice. So basically, they take Wen's dynamics, which were applied to a fixed system, and they apply this to the same dynamics almost. They have to add one term to this system. And they find you get the freezing out of space plus the photons as excitations. Okay. So I'd like to show you, if I have time, another example like that. And I want to consider a theory. And this is a whole class of results. I'm not sure who to attribute this to. But let me consider a theory of three matrices, A, I, where, so these are large n by n commission matrices. So those are my fundamental degrees of freedom. There's not actually that much difference between these and those because if you have a graph, there's a notion of the adjacency matrix of the graph, Aij, which is equal to 1 if there's a node between, if there's an edge between the nodes I and j, and 0 if there's not. So there's a big interplay between symmetric matrices. Symmetric matrices are like fancy graphs. And this, what I'm about to say, it's a little bit easier to say this in the graph, in the matrix language, but if you want to say this in a graph language, there is a related model. So, and I equals 1, 2, and 3, and the time derivative of A1 is the commutator as matrices of the matrices A2, and A3 and symmetric. actually, there's something even simpler than that. Supposing that the commutator of A2 and A3 is zero, then that implies that A dot one is zero, but I still have A2 dot is the commutator of A1 and A3 dot, this is minus sign there, is the commutator of A1 and A2. And here, what's interesting is that A2 and A3 are allowed to evolve. A1 can stay constant as long as the commutator of A2 and A3 is zero. But consider that system. So there's a system with time, but with no space, but with many, many, many degrees of freedom.
We know space bounded?
No, I certainly don't know if it does stay bounded. Now, I think I only have 10 minutes, so I'm not going to do this now. This is also a model in which a notion of space emerges. But I think I didn't want to do more physics after this time, but let me just assert that there's a notion of space which emerges from a study of some solutions of this system. If people want, then I can discuss that at the beginning of next time. So there's also some, there's also emergence. It's just done in such a way that I need to take two or three blackboards through elementary quantum mechanics and Fourier transforms to.
Is the presence of a time derivative in the theory sufficient and necessary for time to be in the theory, or just sufficient? I mean, I have in mind just classical thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. There's time in that theory, but there are no time derivatives. Mm-hmm.
Okay, point well taken. I mean, there is evolution into what these are. Examples of is theories where there is evolution of time, of some in time, of some degrees of freedom. So there's a Hamiltonian, there's equation of motion, there's lawful evolution in time, some degrees of freedom, and space is emergent. Or not. That is, there are many solutions where there is no notion of space, and there are some solutions where there is a notion of space. And I'm sorry, I missed time to lecture, so that we'll have to postpone discussing that. In these last two kinds of examples, these happen to be examples in which the continuum manifold is emergent, at least of space. So there are such examples. Um, So I just, I want to put here just that there are examples where space is emergent and time is not. And it's plausible in these examples, in both kinds of examples. By the way, these examples hidden under here go under the name of matrix models. And the one place they appear is in string theory. In the work that there is on making a non-perturbative formulation of string theory is all based on models like this, in which the fundamental degrees of freedom are basically large arrays of numbers, and they have simple dynamics and a long path connects some solutions of those dynamics to the propagation of fields or strings in manifolds. And let me know if there's interest. That stuff is a bit technical, but if there's interest, I'm happy to expose it. I just posted a paper about that, so I'm up on that at the moment. And it's also an approach which is closely tied to loop quantum gravity and indeed closely tied to the Lebesgue approach. So my point is, there are the idea that the metric is emergent is one that there's work that serves as examples of that. There are open questions. The idea that space could be emergent and time not. Again, there are examples, there are research programs which discuss that. If time is emergent and space is not, I'm sorry, if space is emergent and time is not emergent, then causality is emergent, apparently, and causal structure is emergent, which means, as I was discussing here, that what degrees of freedom are interacting to each other, the fact that this edge interacts with this edge strongly and doesn't interact with this edge directly, is a consequence of this solution. That is, if I study small excitations of this solution, I get waves which propagate, which is what's interpreted as photons, and in which the degrees of freedom here and here are strongly coupled, and the degrees of freedom here and here are only coupled to a sequence of interaction. But who is coupled to who is a consequence in a small fluctuation, is a consequence of which solutions you're expanding about. Therefore, what degrees of freedom are local to each other and what are not is a consequence of what solution one is expanding about. So there's a notion of locality being emergent, of local physics being emergent. And these things are under our research programs. This is an entirely different animal, and that's really what I wanted to say about it. That is, the notion that time is also emergent is different. The notion that time is also emergent, there are examples of, it puts us back in the Hamiltonian constraint and the discussions we had about whether time and dynamics is indeed emergent from solutions of the Hamiltonian constraint. So it is also a research program, but it's a research program which is much more challenging than the research program of just getting to here or just getting to here. And I think what I'd like to do, so we're going to start to have some guest lectures, but what I'd like to do in the next class, in the next, is go back over those claims, look at them again more closely, and try to decide if they're believable or not. And I think there it would be nice to really have some critical discussion because, again, I'm just expressing my view, but it's entirely plausible that space emerges, that locality emerges, that continuum emerges. The notion that time emerges is different. And let me just close off the discussion of this class by saying, I mean, the Ted Jacobson argument is an invitation to think of us as to think about general relativity as emergent in the Einstein equations as thermodynamic equations. The question in this context is, what should be the character of that fundamental theory? And let me make a kind of, not quite a paradox, but whatever it is that philosophers do when they try to approach paradox. There's a name for that. Okay. You'll tell me. Which is that theory that Ted Jacobson has in mind and that he wrote that paper to argue for, either has time as a fundamental aspect of it, as a fundamental part of the language of description of it, or it does not. Now, if it does not, then you might be puzzled, given Harvey's comment, on why there's thermodynamics. That is, thermodynamics has a notion of temperature, which implies a notion of energy, which certainly seems to imply a notion of time. There's a notion of equilibrium, which is, you know, things are not changing in time, but equilibrium seems to be meaningful because there might have been a possibility of things changing in time. So if you think that time is emergent, then what's the status of the use of the laws of thermodynamics in Jacobson's argument? On the other hand, if you think that time is more fundamental than the metric, more fundamental than the Einstein equations, more fundamental than causal structure, which is what Ted's argument is suggesting, then what is the notion of simultaneity that's relevant? In these two models, and I didn't have time to discuss them much, but in these quantum gravity models and the matrix models, there is a built-in element of simultaneity. At the fundamental level, all degrees of freedom are talking to each other all the time. In those equations, you know, A dot 1 is the commutator of A2 and A3 and cyclic. Everybody is talking to everybody all the time. Therefore, there just simply is an old-fashioned Newtonian simultaneity which somehow gets broken up when locality emerges. But if you believe that, then you believe that somewhere hidden under general relativity, there probably is a preferred frame of rest which physics should ultimately discover. And that is what Ted Jacobson believes, and that is what much of his research is focused on, is extending the Einstein equations by the consequence of there being a preferred surface of simultaneity, which is why the recent stuff, the last several years, is called the Einstein ether theory. It's sort of he's looking for the minimal consequences of combining the Einstein equation with the hypothesis that if you look really closely, you would discover a preferred frame everywhere. And he does that because he believes that there is a preferred notion of simultaneity. And the people who work on emergent gravity, whether it's Laughlin or Wen or Fotini or Volovich, all really believe in a fundamental simultaneity. Therefore, they believe that the relativity of simultaneity, of special relativity, is an approximation good at some scale, but ultimately false. Because ultimately there is a preferred reference frame. So that's the sort of two sides of the, I don't know what the word is. Come on, there is a word. It's not a syllogism.
Dilemma.
A dilemma, okay. The two sides of the dilemma that Ted's argument points out, either If you buy the consequences of it, then either time is not fundamental at all, in which case, where do the laws of thermodynamics come from, and what's notions of energy and temperature doing as in the fundamental language of description where time does not exist, or time is more fundamental than space, than the metric, than the continuum, in which case, is the relativity of simultaneity only an approximation to some old-fashioned idea that this preferred frame of reference? So I'll stop there.
Okay. Can you say what's the motivation behind thinking that there should be a preferred simultaneity basis? Why should there be?
Well, I gave one that if you, there, Ted's argument, I gave two, so I mentioned, let me summarize. The one connected with Ted's argument, well, there are several arguments that suggest that the Einstein equations are really reflections of some more fundamental degrees of freedom understood at the level of thermodynamics of those degrees of freedom. So if there is thermodynamics of those underlying degrees of freedom, then there is energy. If there is a non-zero energy, which is necessary to talk about temperature, then that implies that there is a time. If there's no, if there's a time and an energy at a level of description where there's no space, then when that description in space emerges, it's still there.
But thermodynamics could be considered relativistic. I mean, there's a whole theory of relativistic thermodynamics.
Maybe that's the answer.
I mean, it could be that the laws of thermodynamics look the same in every coordinate system, in every inertial frame. I mean, I don't know that you're necessarily committing yourself.
But the issue is not, I mean, I see that to your point for a minute, but I'm not going to pull away. The issue is not whether thermodynamics is special relativistic or not. The issue is if you have thermodynamics at a level of description before you have the metric, before you have light cones, before you have space.
Well, I couldn't understand. I mean, maybe I need to study Jacobson's theory better, but the Unruh effect, I mean, insofar as you're appealing to something like the Unruh effect, it sounds as if something like the Minkowski metric is already embedded in the fundamental theory.
No, the assumption is not that. The assumption is, or the research program is, that there's something like quantum gravity underlying the fundamental theory. There's something with no continuum, no space. There's an approximation to it, which is based on a continuous description of space with a metric, in precisely the same sense that continuum mechanics, that is a continuous description of stresses and stresses in a metal, is a very coarse approximation to what really is a bunch of atoms interacting with each other that only contingently are all joined together in a piece of metal, such that the continuum description is accessible.
But I mean, if you look at, but I don't see why you're committed to that. I mean, what about the approach of, say, Visser and Liberati? These guys are just simply saying you have some fundamental field theory.
Yes, and their fundamental field theory is generally not special relativity. It's ordinary Newtonian field theory. And there's a speed of sound, and what's in common, so I haven't studied their work in detail, but we had a workshop where they spoke, and I've heard their talks. And the common element is that you can put a material into a special critical state where the relationship between the wave vector and the frequency is linear in some range of phenomena. It's usually in a non-relativistic material, omega goes like k squared over some mass, and that's a consequence, and that requires a preferred frame. But there are some special critical states. You can put a material so that the spectrum of Bolian excitation satisfies omega proportional to k.
A chunk of regular material will do. That's just a sound wave.
Right. Okay. So what's interesting is not that that's a sound wave. It's not that it's a sound wave. What's interesting is that all, so that's a sound wave, and somewhere there is the speed of sound. And what's interesting about those special, they're theoretical materials, is that you can have many different excitations which all have the same speed of sound. So that a experimentalist which only had access to the low-lying excitations could confuse themselves and believe that they were not in a material with a preferred rest frame, but that they were in a world described by special relativity.
Yeah, okay.
But those, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I mean, those theories, at least to the extent that I've looked at them, they start with something like they model it with a BEC or something like that,
yes.
Right? So you start with a field theory where there are space and variables.
Yes.
Right? And so how does Ben one? So that's different than these emergent.
Than this full emergent, yes.
Sort
yes.
of things. But in that theory, at a deep level, you seem to have both space and time.
Yes. So that's right. So that's an example of B or whatever. The metric degrees of freedom are emergent. The notion of the causal structure is emergent of a particular phase or a particular critical state of the material. Okay. But there is space and time, but it is Newtonian space.
Right. It's yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know about Matt. I mean, Matt Visser, I think, is a more nuanced point of view, shall I say. I mean, if you ask Laughlin, then he just says, well, that's just the way it is, and everything is just a non-relativistic spin system. And that's not a complete, before dismissing that as crazy, one could ask what are the strengths of that point of view and what are the experimental tests. And one strength is, in fact, that they're vulnerable to experimental tests because one would hope to see terms. So if omega squared, let me just square it, omega squared is like k squared of all energy, one would hope to see terms that go like k cubed.
Yeah.
Or k to the fourth. And I think as I talked about, I think I did talk about this before, such terms are experimentally probable in the present day with gamma ray bursts and other experiments.
One sort of nice feature of those is that if you buy this, if one now thinks about the quantum issues, if you buy the fact that the state of your condensate, let's say in that model, is indeed in fact a condensed state, then with the ansatz of the symmetry breaking necessary to give you the condensed state, you essentially get a classical metric.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Now, that, if I understand correctly, does not happen in the Plavatsky approach, right?
The Plavatsky is, at least at first sight, very different.
Right, yeah. But I mean, it seems in some sense there are sort of philosophical connections between it and say, the Visser stuff. I mean, you start with a kind of fundamental field and some kind of fundamental variables that are different than normal space and time. I mean, you've got everything's diffeomorphic out there, and
That's not nothing.
I understand, but still, yeah. They share a spirit.
Yes. And that spirit is haunting many of our presidents. Let me just ask, because we're running over. Guys at Western, any comments, questions?
No.
Okay. Let's just go, since there is interest, a couple more. You had a comment.
Well, it's a few minutes out of date now. We were asking about preferred frames of reference.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was just going to say that you don't need to go too far to get at least globally a preferred frame of reference, even within special relativity. All you need is, say, multi-connected space, like the Toro space, you have to have a preferred frame of reference globally, although not locally.
Yes. No, that's true. That's true, and could be relevant. And there's an observational search for if the signatures of such so-called small universes or, you know, multi-connected topology.
Sure. But when you talk cosmologically, you can simply say cosmic time gives you the number of those. Yes. You don't even need a multi-connected.
No. All of that. Okay. All of that is. Okay.
Especially if you're a strict operationalist and you say the universe is just running about what's in it.
We're confusing things here. There's two. I mean, we can define cosmic time. We can refer to motion with respect to the cosmic microwave background, all that stuff. That's got nothing to do with what we mean by preferred time in the dynamics.
Right.
We're not talking about the furniture of the world. We're talking about how things change over time,
right,
the laws.
Right.
Now, in that case, either the laws pick out a preferred simultaneity relation or they don't.
Right.
But the thing is, when we talk of issues in quantum gravity, the line between the laws and the furniture, as you say, is movable. There is wiggle room there.
I find this line of discussion is very important. I find it quite challenging because, again, let me throw up two disparate things. One is very vulnerable to thoughts or self-accusations of cheapening out, giving up, etc., if one imagines that one no longer has to make a fundamental theory consistent with the requirements of special relativity, which has served as a very true guide throughout the 20th century. On the one hand, and one also has to worry that once you open up quantum theory to violations of asymmetry, this is an argument made by different people in different ways, but there is an argument that you can't control it. Your small breakings of Lorentz invariants will become big in some experimental situations.
Yeah.
And so you have to be very careful and think very carefully about that. On the other side, I really want to believe in the existence of an equivalence of our situation here with an observer who would see this 10 shrunk to a billionth of the Planck line. You know, do I really want my view of nature to commit myself to believing in boosts that shrink things by powers of, you know, 10 to the 30 or 10 to the 40. In fact, special relativity is tested most recently up to boosts of, I think, 10 to the 17, which is, I think, what the OJ experiment, assuming it's the interpretation people have given currently, is correct. And 10 to the 17, the boost of 10 to the 17 is pretty impressive. That brings the Hubble scale to closer than the distance to the nearest star. So that's pretty impressive, but do we want to bring the Hubble scale, this is another way of saying what I just said, do we want to bring the Hubble scale, you know, to within the size of an atom? Do we want to believe in the equivalence of observers who are moving relative to us so fast that, which means in their frame of reference, they cross the entire observable universe in a small fraction of a second of their perceived time? And I don't know. I'm troubled on both sides.
Is there a strong reason why on your list A to D there is the option that only time could be emerging, but space not? It's not mentioned.
I suppose that should be.
Is there a research program corresponding to that as well? Or?
Well, yes, and in fact, there is. Of course, there's the weird, the standard really.
Okay,
it's too late in the day to put something else there, but yes. Okay, let me just take the last few comments and let's go on. Mr. Shaw?
It's just, I think, it's related to something you said earlier, but also related to this discussion about the difference between the furniture of the universe and the laws. And I think it's because when you mentioned this fundamental sense of time that sort of you want to believe in, when you look at Jacobson's arguments, it strikes me as that might originate in the initial setup for the holographic hypothesis, which is a black hole that is not time reversal symmetric in the first place. So you, I mean, the second that you say you have a black hole horizon, you're assuming this thing is just going straight up through time, right? So you're picking very strange boundary conditions. I don't know if that argument's true or not, but
well, you're going somewhere with that. But
yeah. And where I'm going is not 100% worked out, but like it just seems to me that there is something that when you break down the holographic hypothesis, you're really singling out time as something different than space already.
Yeah.
And it seems like maybe that initial separation survived all the way to this level, and then so you have to be careful whether or not that's actually just a way of setting up the boundary conditions of the universe, right? That's how you do the black hole.
Well, I would. So I think I see part of your point, but I would say, I would think about reorganizing in the following way.
Okay.
The question about the initial conditions is why we don't see black holes.
Right.
Which is why black holes are related to thermodynamic systems. Black holes are generic endpoints. They're high entropy. They're generic endpoints of evolution from random initial conditions. White holes are extremely special initial conditions. Or at least so you might argue. Okay. I think this has been very fruitful. I'll send an email. I'm not completely sure where we go from here. Pardon, you should jump in.
We should talk
about that. So let's talk about that tomorrow. And we'll get Raphael, and then there's some other people I'm discussing and presenting. I want to turn the discussion back to, we didn't get to the issue of laws, but the issue of laws and initial conditions I'll discuss the next time I talk, because we're closing in on it. So thanks very much.